Well, last week we embarked on our Lenten journey, and I introduced the theme I'm proposing we explore over these weeks of preparation for Easter. It's to do with the shape and process of our collective recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. And this inquiry, as I said last week, was prompted for me by the book called Upturn, A Better Normal After COVID-19, Neville drew to my attention. The book's edited by Tanya Plibersek of the Australian Labor Party and comprises contributions by leading practitioners from a range of fields. And again, as I said last week, there's much in the volume's vision with which I agree. But what has struck me is the absence of any sense that there's a spiritual dimension to this work of recovery, or that religious communities, faith-based worldviews, or spiritual practice may have a part to play in generating the better normal to which the essays aspire. In fact, during this week, another member of our community, Peter Yule, pointed out an irony in the fact that the proceeds of the book go to the Reverend Bill Cruz Foundation and the Wayside Chapel, as if, he said, those institutions can be endorsed for doing good works, but apparently that's where their contribution to a post-COVID world ends. Yet having raised this issue, when I ask myself what actually is missing from the book, or what is the distinctive contribution of faith-based communities to this work of recovery, I don't find it so easy to articulate. It has something to do with the values we hold and wish to see lived out, but by itself, that's not enough. The authors of Upturn share a vision of justice and the common good to which many of us, I think, could commit. So there's something else I think we need to get at. And at the end of last week's reflection, I invited members of Benedictus to share with me in this work of inquiry. What do you sense that your practice of faith and prayer make available for your life and work? What goodness and grace does it enable? And what's missing if it's not active or engaged? Already a number of you have been in touch to share your reflections, and I'm looking forward to more of this dialogue as part of our series. So tonight I want to continue our exploration in relation to a key issue that confronts many societies at this time. It's the question of how we relate and respond to difference. Differences of opinion and political allegiance, as well as differences of race, religion, ethnicity, sexuality, and gender. It's the question of how, in a post-COVID world, the polarisation of discourse and dehumanisation of the other that is apparent in too much of our public life might be transformed for the good of all. This theme is explored in Upturn, particularly in relation to racism, by Professor Tim Soutphommasane. Professor Soutphommasane was born of Chinese and Lao parents. They were refugees who fled Laos in 1975. He was formerly Race Discrimination Commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission and is currently a professor in sociology and political theory at Sydney University. He begins his essay by noting that minorities rarely fare well during pandemics. During the bubonic plague of the 14th century in Europe, Jews were accused of poisoning wells, and suffered pogroms in retaliation. Outbreaks of cholera in the US in the 19th and 20th centuries were blamed respectively on Irish Catholics and Chinese people. And so it has been, he says, with COVID-19. Not the Irish Catholic bit, but... Given the pandemic's origin in Wuhan, China, there has been, he writes, a predictable surge in anti-Asian racism in many countries, including in Australia. Sutpamasan then goes on to write of the dangers posed more generally by the ascendancy of populist nationalism in various countries. Think Trump and the alt-right, Brexit, Fortress Australia. This is a nationalism that inevitably generates itself against foreigners and so-called globalism. And he argues that combating these tendencies in a multicultural society will require a more emphatic public stance against racism, especially at the political level. Significantly increased racial diversity in the leadership of institutions and appropriate pathways to citizenship for migrants. He speaks also of the significance of small acts of solidarity between citizens. The little things, the small gestures and exchanges between us have taken on new meaning, he writes. For a multicultural nation such as ours, it has become all the more urgent to stamp out the racism, often insidious, creeping into the lives of many of our fellow Australians. And with all this, I agree. The question Sutpamasan doesn't ask, however, is what lies at the root of this terrible human pattern of weaponising difference. Whether racial, religious, sexual, political, and so on. What is it that enables its exploitation and manipulation, especially in times of crisis and social stress, such that in our day, whole media outlets can dedicate themselves to undermining the solidarity of citizens, fomenting anger, blame, and misunderstanding. And how is it that this polarising, aggressive, merciless way of seeing and being towards the other finds all too often such a receptive listening? Well, at heart, I wonder if it has to do with the sources of our identity, or where our identity is sourced. John Mayne wrote, "What we discover in meditation is the power source that enables us to live without the anxiety of having to protect ourselves. It is established right at the centre of our own being, in our own hearts. God is the centre of my soul." The human default, by contrast, is to establish ourselves at the centre of our souls. We seek, not consciously, but as a built-in feature of the human operating system, to possess and sustain our identity, our meaning, our value, out of our own resources. This can be more or less problematic. Sometimes the identities we live from are intrinsically falsifying, based in stories about our worthlessness or weakness, for example. Or in stories about our racial, ethnic, or religious superiority. At other times, the identities we live from can be rich, and at least to a point, true. And particularly when my humanity has been dishonoured and subjugated in a given culture, because I'm black or gay, indigenous or female, it can be enormously liberating and empowering to come to know, honour and accept who I am. Yet even here, the danger is that as long as my ultimate meaning and sense of self is given by an identity I control or need to assert, it also becomes something I need to defend against attack or perceived threat. Something that can be threatened by the words and actions, even the being of others. Our egoic identity, this identity I'm talking about that we possess or assert, is always fragile, incipiently anxious, self-protecting, competing for acknowledgement and enlargement. And this means that when I feel myself threatened at this level, I tend to react violently. Someone criticises or disvalues me, and my immediate instinct is to push back, find something to criticise or disvalue in them. Someone blames me or calls me to account, and I blame them right back, or at least energetically justify myself. I'm made to believe, by Sky News, that a group of people, migrant workers, transgender people, or left-wing radicals, threaten my security or my sense of my own goodness, and I want them wiped from the social and political landscape. Our egoic identity is intrinsically threatened by difference and disagreement and prone to violence. And this is why, said Howard Thurman, the African American theologian and civil rights leader, it's why he said the real transformation of such attitudes like racism or different kinds of threatened being, it's possible only on the basis of a transformative encounter with God. Only in that encounter does the soul open itself to a new way of living, of being. In the mystical encounter of prayer, people are driven to confront the core issue of violence, the self-righteous and egoistic self. And he goes on, the ego is thereby displaced from its throne, replaced by the desire for union with the beauty of God. Our false selves are undone, and we realise the dignity of every person. Well, this transformative encounter is what we practice in meditation, as we deliberately lay down the self-reinforcing stories that keep our egoic identity in place and at the centre. And this, I take it, is what Jesus is teaching. Peter has just rebuked him for not resisting the threat to his life. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things, egoic things. And he goes on, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake, and for the sake of the gospel, that is the good news of God's love for all, they will save it. So this isn't about being a doormat. It's about letting go our threatened egoic identities so as to discover beyond them a self, a capacity for being that's infinitely more spacious and loving. A self that knows its communion with God and with all. This shift in the ground of our identity doesn't magically remove fundamental disagreements we may have about the direction of a society or how we realise it. There remain differences in culture and values, as well as injustices that need to be named and confronted, overcome. But it does shift how we relate to our differences and their meaning. For now, these differences between us signify not the end, but the beginning of discourse and engagement. And the more we know ourselves sourced beyond our egoic identities, sourced in the one who makes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, people like us and the people not like us, the more this same unreasoning love for all people somehow penetrates and transforms my own responsiveness. Well, as you well know, religion is often implicated in the weaponizing of difference. In fact, it's seen by many as more likely to be part of the problem than the solution, and often it is. But what I'm suggesting is that contemplative practice, the practice of learning to leave our egoic selves behind, learning to disinvest in how seriously we take them. This, in fact, is our only real access to truly being in communion. Tim Soutphommasane writes, the kind of nation we rebuild, the kind of social contract we reenact, will be determined not just by government, but by us as citizens. It encompasses, as he says, ordinary acts of kindness between us. And it seems to me that our capacity for these acts, ordinary and extraordinary, will reflect the extent to which we can be genuinely with each other, struck by the wonder and beauty of the other, and glad to share a world. This isn't a matter, then, just of sincere conviction and good intention. It involves the slow, patient work of being displaced from my self-centeredness and self-defendedness, being so yielded to God that the love of God grows within me. For this, as Martin Luther King said, is the only way to create the beloved community.